This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. I hope you're hungry because Nigella Lawson is with us here today. She's been described as a British kitchen vixen compared to an old-fashioned Italian movie star, and she's written an instruction manual on how to be a domestic goddess, though I should point out that the domestic goddess phrase is uttered with tongue firmly in cheek. Nigella Lawson is rapidly becoming one of Great Britain's most famous exports and international food star. In this country, her television shows Nigella Bites and Forever Summer can currently be seen on the Style Network, and a line of kitchen products with her distinctive style and signature robin's egg blue color is available in stores around the U.S. A book adapted from the Forever Summer series is full of easy seasonal recipes. We hope she'll share a few of those with us today. If you have questions for Nigella Lawson about cooking, about celebrity, television, and the competitive domestic diva business, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Nigella Lawson joins us from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you so much. What a build-up.
Oh, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. tell us a little bit how you built up. You went to university there in Britain and then started looking for work, not in the cooking business, but as a writer.
Well, that's right. I did a degree at Oxford University in medieval and modern languages, and I started off in publishing, and then I realised actually that journalism interested me more. But I started off as a critic. I mean, I've had just about every job in the business in a newspaper, except on the sports or business pages. But I look forward to that in my old age. But I've been a film critic. I was a book reviewer for a long time. I was on the arts pages. And I did write about food at the same time. I started a restaurant column in the British Spectator.
Reviewing restaurants.
And I was always interested in food. I mean, I cooked a lot. I mean, I think it's very difficult to write about food unless you have an interest in the practical application of it. But what interested me most, I suppose, as a writer was how you use language to describe food and to describe the sensation of eating and the various kind of sensory world that you occupy when you eat or when you're involved with food. And that interests me a lot because, you know, you develop a style over the years, but I think it's very important to find that voice. And my first book was really more interested in, well, I suppose, a slight... the story of food from a personal point of view, why I liked what I did, why I cooked the way I did. And I felt very much that the whole of cooking had been taken over by the professional. And I'm not a professional by any means. But I think that, you know, we would have fallen out of the evolutionary loop a long time ago if you needed... to have a diploma before you're allowed to cook something.
The literary background comes out in some of your programs. You compare at one point making mayonnaise to reading Henry James. What's the comparison?
Well, I'll tell you what it was, is that I used to be mad about Henry James when I was young. And then suddenly someone said, I think a friend of my grandmother said, oh, I've always found him awfully difficult. And I was reading The Golden Bowl at the time, and I suddenly... found his sentences impenetrable, and it hadn't occurred to me to see him that way before. I just loved his style. And the same way about making mayonnaise, I didn't know that people didn't make their own mayonnaise at home, because my mother always did, and everyone kept saying to me that it was very hard to make, and then soon after I found that it curdled very easily. And I didn't know that before. I didn't know it was meant to be difficult. And I think in a way, that's quite a lesson for a lot about cooking, which is that people expect it to be more complicated than it is because they try to make it more complicated than it is. Or perhaps, you know, there are very many people who are restaurant chefs who are capable of great things, which I'm not. So that makes life much simpler. When people say to me, I love your recipes because I can do all of them, and I say, that's not because I'm trying to do it that way. It's because I don't have the talent to make them difficult.
Well, as you say, you aren't trained. I mean, wasn't that considered a drawback when they first thought about you starting a cooking show? I mean, you're no chef.
I'm certainly no chef. Sometimes people say, as a form of criticism, well, you know, she's not a proper chef. I say, thank you very, very much. For me, that's a compliment. Not that I dislike chefs, because, you know, I love proper restaurant food, but I don't try and be that. I don't know why I did a cooking show. I certainly never thought I would. I mean, I had a book show before that, or I used to do current affairs, and then suddenly there I was, you know, chopping things. What happened was, the Channel 4 in Great Britain saw an early instalment of my book that had been serialised, my first book, and bought an option. And I said to them, look, please, I really have no desire to do television, to do a food show. It seemed to me like a joke that they might ask me to do it, because I thought I'm incredibly clumsy, and I thought if I start trying wielding a knife on television, then you know someone's going to get hurt. and that did sometimes happen. I did have to go and have stitches during the making of one of my shows. But what happened was is that I suddenly felt, well, I'd written a food book without ever thinking I'd write a food book, because I wanted to talk about why food mattered, I suppose, not just in terms of the formula of a recipe, but why it mattered in life, or why I felt it did. And why couldn't I do the same for a show? So I agreed, very grudgingly, to do a pilot show, and it worked. And as long as I wasn't being bullied into anything I didn't want, I'm never scripted, which you can be sure made them feel pretty panicked for the first series. Because I believe, as I still do, that it's much better, as you hear me now, I stumble a bit because I'm thinking as I talk. And I felt that viewers would prefer that in a TV show than someone who was just speaking off an autocue, because then you're trying to remember something. And I really thought, I want to make this as honest as I can. I'm cooking in my own kitchen. I'm talking as I think of things. And that seemed to work, because I think it's much easier to be spontaneous if you have no training. Because not only have I no training in the kitchen, I have no training as a performer. So it's easier for me just to go in and just blunder my way through it.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email, TOTN, at npr.org. And why don't we begin with Sasha, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm thrilled to be talking to Nigella. I just wanted to say thank you. You are the first TV chef I have watched in 30 years of watching cooking shows who actually encouraged me to cook.
Oh, thank you. It's a lovely thing to say.
Just watching you in your home, in your own kitchen with your kids around and your friends around, it was wonderful. I went out and bought How to Cook and started with a roast chicken.
That's where everything in life starts, with a roast chicken.
And I'll tell you, I didn't cook for the first 14 years of my marriage, and just cooking a roast chicken was the best thing I ever did. It was tremendous. So no question, just a comment to say
thank you.
You're great.
Well, Sasha, before we let you go, what did she do to encourage you?
She wasn't, it was just like she was talking about before, she wasn't hung up on technique. It was, and actually, there's an episode where you made ice cream in the morning, and you put it in the freezer, and you said, you know, you can do this. Yeah, you're working and you're busy, but throw this stuff into a Tupperware, stick it in the freezer, it'll be ready when you get home. You know, nobody else says that. Nobody else says you can have a job and have your kids and make ice cream. So,
well, you know, one of the things I think is quite important is to keep honest. And in a sense, there's something that Tony Blair once said about children, which is that they drive you mad but keep you sane. And I think that's true, because I cook in the same context that people who read me or who watch me cook, because I do have to collect the children from school at a certain stage in the day, and I can't plan too much. And often I would think, oh, I'd really love to cook that, and then I didn't have the time, and if I didn't have the time, well, then no one else was going to. So it helps, you know, it helps, because I don't have endless time, and I don't have, you know, a huge kitchen staff. And I think in many ways, in a restaurant, that you can do so many wonderful things, but you do probably have a brigade of 30 to help you. And although I can sometimes bully people to do a lot of the work, not so much that I'm separate from it.
Sasha, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Sasha.
Let's talk now with David. David's with us on the phone from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
Nigel, I love your show. And I just,
thank you.
When you said that you weren't a professional chef, it just reminded me that Julia Child is not a professional chef either.
And, well, that's a very, I'm very, very flattered by any comparison to her. Thank you.
Well, I mean, you just have a way on TV. And a while ago, I was watching you prepare your pineapple and molasses spare ribs on TV, and I couldn't get everything down, and I was just kind of bummed. And then a couple weeks later, I saw this. You had an article in the New York Times with the recipe, and I grabbed that, and am doing that tonight for a catering function for a woman who's having her 50th birthday party in my house. And
oh, God, that's great.
The pineapple and molasses spare ribs for her. And they came out, and they were phenomenal.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Yeah, I'm just having a ball with this.
I'm really pleased.
But I want to thank you, and I love your show.
Thank you so much.
And was the recipe, David, as easy as advertised?
It is, yes. And, in fact, I did them last night, and around 12:30 in the morning, I pulled them out of the oven and had about six of them. The smell was just unbelievable.
Now, did you sneak down the stairs in the middle of the night with your bathrobe on and grab a snack?
No, I was still working. You know, I got to tell you, when you're catering,
I thought you were going to say I was naked.
It was fun, and it was well worth it.
Oh, thanks.
David, thanks for the call.
Take care.
Nigella Lawson, I did want to ask you about that house that Sasha, our earlier caller,
yes,
referred to. That is, or rather was, your house.
It was my house. I don't live there now. My sister lives there now, so I go back. Yes, it was my house.
And you have written that you started getting interested in cooking as really a result of family tragedy. Your mother and your sister both died.
Yes, I wouldn't say that's what started me getting interested in cooking, because we all cooked, but it was certainly my connection with them had been severed, and so many of our conversations would start, and we'll do cooking for dinner tonight, and it would always be answered, invariably be roast chicken, I suppose, but or something along those lines, and I felt I needed to fill that gap, not that, you know, their gap could be filled, but I needed somehow that conversation about food, that sense of being connected to the world through food, and that use food as a cipher, you could say, was really important. So that's where it came from. It wasn't, I had no idea of wanting to be a TV person, or I had no idea of even thinking of it in terms of celebrity or anything like that, which makes me, you know, when I'm called a celebrity chef, you know, I recoil, you know, because I think I'm not a chef, and, you know, the word celebrity really makes me feel, no, please don't, you know, please no. Because I think that food is not about show, and it's not about showing off, if you like. Those two things aren't what it is for me. For me, it's about a connection with life and with people. And so what I like about hearing the callers is that people respond in that way. I don't want people, you know, to want my photograph. I want them to tell me their stories about food and how they feel about cooking and what's mattered to them in their lives. And I think that maybe that's why people respond, because it is really perhaps one of the most direct and most intimate forms of conversation you can have.
I raised the question earlier of your mother's and your sister's cancer in was a way of approaching a difficult subject, but your husband also developed cancer and wrote about it very publicly. He was a journalist himself who wrote about it in a column for the newspapers there. It became a book and a television show as well. At the same time, you were cooking.
Well, when you say it became a television show, I hasten to add
it wasn't a reality show.
That no. The BBC made a documentary about him.
Yes, indeed. But this was also going on as you were beginning to achieve some celebrity.
Well, what happened was, really, is that I probably would never have thought of doing the TV show at home had John been well, but I didn't feel at all comfortable about leaving him. So, not that he was incredibly sick all the time, so I needed to be there. So these two things did have something in common. And a girlfriend of mine said that because John had cancer of the mouth and throat, you know, he stopped being able to eat fairly early on after his diagnosis. And I suppose, you know, you don't have to be, you know, the great Dr. Freud to notice that there is a connection between someone trying to feed as many people as possible if you can't feed the person, you know, you love and are married to. So there are many connections and there are many ironies, but life is what happens. And so that's, you know, that's what happened, both, you know, the terrible things and the good things, and they happen together.
Nigella Lawson is the author of How to Eat, her most recent book, Forever Summer, and she's also the host of Nigella Bites. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email if you'd like. The address, totn@npr.org. And you can see Nigella's recipe for slow roasted chicken at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Nigella Lawson, British food writer and host of Forever Summer on the Style Television Network. Her She's also working on a forthcoming book called Feast. You can join us at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN@npr.org. And let's get another caller on. This is Judy, who's with us from Valdez, North Carolina.
Yes, hello, Nigella.
Hi.
Hi, I enjoy your program so much. I love the way you say things like grindingly dull. And also, are you familiar with MSK Fisher? And do you like
her?
I like her, or one of her books is The Measure of Her Powers, and she speaks about being in France and putting sections of tangerine in the radiator.
Right,
do you know, I used to do that at school as well. It's a really strange thing that it's so lovely the way it gets kind of warm and crackly on the outside.
Mm-hmm. It made me so hungry, and your program makes me hungry too. Just eating out the refrigerator at night makes me hungry.
Oh, thanks.
But congratulations on your program, and we all enjoy it where I live.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Judy.
Thank you.
You and MFK Fisher both use the word voluptuous a lot to describe some of the things you do.
Well, food, in a way, a voluptuary seeks to get as much pleasure as possible from life, and that seems to me not a bad thing to do when you're eating. I think the rest of life sometimes, you know, that can't always happen. I don't see why you would want an unpleasurable meal.
Let's get another caller in. Chantal joins us from Anchorage, Alaska.
Good morning, Neil. Hi, Nigella.
Hello.
I love your show. And up here in Alaska, I used to get it on the E! Network, but I no longer get it anymore. But I'm a single mother, and I don't normally cook. You know, I buy all the equipment, but I don't normally cook. But your recipes are really simple, and one that I really appreciated. I'm not a ham fan, and I'm not from the South, but the cooking ham...
I know, that really works, doesn't it?
Right, and it does really work, and it's really great, but I'm just glad...
Wait a minute, Chantal, this is Coca-Cola and ham?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How does that work?
Well, it's like a glaze.
Well, you cook
on
it,
the ham, and it's really good.
Maybe you could explain a little bit more, Nigella.
I certainly can. Well, I read that in the Deep South that sometimes Coca-Cola is used for cooking ham, and the only recipes I saw were incredibly complicated. And what I do is when I see a recipe, is I always try and think, how can I do this in much less time and with far fewer steps? So this is what I do. I get an uncooked ham, and I put it in a pan, and I fill a little pan up with Coca-Cola. Just to show that I am doing something, I also peel an onion and put it in. And then I cook it, and I would say, bring it to the... First, you know, it has to be soaked, but then I let it boil for about 25 minutes a pound. And then I take it out, and I take off the rind, and I score the sort of fatty bit underneath, put a few cloves, and make a paste... And you can do a bit of sugar, a bit of Coca-Cola, a bit of mustard, and put it in a very hot oven. And it's fabulous.
Nigel, I also had one other question. How you seem to manage, you know, work and the TV show. And you always look so glamorous and fabulous when you're padding down to your refrigerator.
Well, you know what?
Over cake.
A makeup artist does wonders for once how glamorous you can look. But the truth is, it is difficult. I haven't made a television program for a while because... While I make TV programs, I'm very much a prisoner in the studio, even if that studio is my home. And recently, you know, because I got married again and my children went to new schools, I haven't done any TV because I felt it was very important to settle them into school. And I love writing, and that's really my first job, if you like. And so that you do make choices in life, and there are certain times in your life when you can't do everything you might think you want to do. And for me, it was more important just to forget that for a while. So it is difficult to do everything. And as I say, certainly don't look glamorous all the time. It's very, very, very fortunate that this is a radio program.
Okay. I'm just one last comment. I love your How to Be a Domestic Goddess book. I just love that
thank
book.
You.
Thank you for the easy, simple recipes for children to help and stuff like that.
Thanks for the call, Chantal.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And I was just going to raise the question that she pointed out at the end there. You do write about and have done some TV shows about cooking for kids.
Yes. Well, I think that's once you have a family, that occupies a lot of your time. And I have to say, the reason why I do so much cooking with children or write about it is not because I'm so fabulous. It's because I'm really, really lazy. And I can't stand having to go to the park and be running about with a football. So cooking with children is about my favourite sort of childcare. it means that you have a lot of clearing up, but at least you don't have to do anything too athletic. And I find as well that children like that. They love the kind of mud pie aspect of cooking. And left to their own devices, they can really learn to understand food. I mean, my mother was a great believer in child labour. And consequently, from a very young age, we were required to help her in the kitchen. And I think that probably made me much less frightened of cooking than those who've grown up in homes where they're not allowed to because it'll make a mess, or because they're a bit clumsy, or just because it is hard work.
Yeah, but so many kids seem to prefer, you know, just the macaroni and cheese out of the box. I mean, you go a little further than that.
Well, I do, but I have to say that my children often do prefer that sort of thing. They do, you know, for a special treat, you know, if they're being very good, we're allowed to phone in for a pizza. So, you know, children are the same everywhere. But I'm a great believer in life that there's room for everything. I'm not a purist. You know, adults too sometimes want something out of a box. But I think that as long as you help encourage their taste buds and also to make them realise what choices there are, then it can only help them. And I do worry that children have very unhealthy diets if everything is processed and huge amounts of starchy fillers put into food that appeal to children. And I'm just a very cruel mother, and I won't let them have, you know, the sort of cheese dipper things that they might ask for. And that's just life, you know. They have to, if the worst thing that happens to them is they're not allowed something they see advertised on television, then they're going to be very fortunate children.
An email question from Melissa. I love to cook, and I find that cooking is more than just words on a recipe card. Do you find yourself constantly changing recipes on a whim just because? And if so, what's the oddest thing you've ever changed?
Well, I do change things on a whim and just because. And I sometimes find that I don't really know in advance, you know, how I'm going to do it. I think to think of odd things, I suppose the Coca-Cola and ham is about as odd as I've got. But that interests me that, you know, she would sort of raise that. And it is true that it's both a whim and not a whim, because really real cooking is about adapting to what you've got, whether the resource is about your resources financially or what you have left over in the fridge, or whether, you know, what kind of a stove you have. And maybe, although it's not an odd thing, I would say that one of my most favourite recipes, which is like a baked rhubarb custard, very good now because rhubarb's coming in, but was you hate rhubarb.
I hate rhubarb.
I know. Well, it's a kind of love it or loathe it. So you're just going to have to suffer a bit now. Which is just happened as a result of something that went wrong. I had my great aunt coming for lunch just after one of my children was born. And I know it's probably not very PC to say this, but your brain does entirely go at those stages. And I was put some rhubarb on to cook, and of course completely forgot about it, and it went to a pulp. So I thought, well, I've got to do something with this. So I just beat up a bit of egg and sugar and added some milk, and then folded this sort of pink pulp into it. But I didn't mix it, I just folded it through, so it was like ribbon through the custard. And I baked that in the oven, and it remains one of my favourite desserts. Now, I wouldn't have made that from scratch. I had to rectify an error. And so often people say, you know, what's gone wrong? And what goes wrong can often make things go right. I feel it's probably, you know, the true in life too. Sometimes you get to a place simply because you've made a mistake somewhere, or you've chosen the wrong job, so you've got to think of another one, or something like that. And there's such an element of randomness in cooking and in life that if you don't respond to that, that's quite difficult.
That sounds delicious, other than that rhubarb part. Let's get another caller on the line. Anne is with us from Westchester, New York.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Nigella.
Hello.
I love you. I love your show. I turned my sisters and my mom onto your show. And
I think she's talking about you, Nigella.
your demeanor is so likable.
Thank you.
A question. I've seen you make a recipe twice on TV, and I've got all the ingredients. I know how to make it. I'm actually going to make it for Mother's Day. I'm not getting the name right, I know. It's something meringue, and it's round, and I think that you put it on a piece of parchment paper.
I mean, the only thing I can remember doing meringue and parchment paper would have been a pavlova.
That's it. Pavlova?
I've done two pavlovas on TV. One, which was just an ordinary meringue, and then with cream and passion fruit, and the other one was flavoured with cocoa, so it was sort of brown and had raspberries and grated chocolate.
That's it, pavlova.
pavlova, named after, well, no one can quite agree whether it's Australian or New Zealand. The two countries row about it all the time. But, you know, she was a ballerina, and it was in her honour because it was like these great, wonderful white floaty skirts with the meringue and cream.
Well, I hope when I make it, it's as easy as when you made it.
Well, I hope so, too. I hope you like it.
Thank you, and good luck to you, and congratulations on your marriage.
Thank you.
Bye, Neil.
Thanks very much for the call, Ann. I wanted to ask you, the somebody from the control room is sending a note. Was the ham and Coca-Cola, was that inspired by Elvis?
No, I have got a recipe inspired by Elvis, which is his fried banana and peanut butter sandwiches, which are a rare and very special delicacy.
Okay.
You can see why he didn't live to be, you know, 90. That's all I can say.
Well, you're not shy about using, to be bald about it, fat.
No, I'm a great believer in but fat being very good for you, and particularly for women, and very good for the skin. That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
In various interviews, it's interesting, going back to the name Pavlova, you've described yourself as melodramatic and melancholic. How does the mood affect the food? I know you have a happiness soup, for example.
Yes. Well, you know, mood affects food in the sense that when you're low, you want to eat more carbohydrate than when you're feeling cheerful. But, you know, I think these are just excuses, because I seem to find an excuse to eat whether I'm happy or sad. There's always a way. I didn't know I'd describe myself as melodramatic. I suppose I can be. I'm fairly controlled as a person, but I did, and I don't know. I don't know if this is a personality thing or whether it was an age thing, because teenagers are prone to melancholy. But I certainly had pretty long depressed bouts mm-hmm. in my teens and early 20s. And one of the things I find that makes aging easy is that anything is better than being young. That's what I feel.
You were painfully shy.
I was. I didn't really talk out loud until I was about 19.
And at one point, I think...
Now I don't stop.
Now you don't stop. You're making up for it. But at one point, you described being shy as a form of arrogance. I found that interesting.
Well, I don't know. My mother, you know, this is, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have mothers who are like this. My mother used to say to me, you can imagine how much this helped. I don't know why you're so shy. I mean, who do you think is interested in you anyway? And actually, although at the time it was pretty crushing, there is a certain, if not arrogance, a certain self-absorption about shyness. And I suppose that also, again, both shyness and self-absorption are really part of teenage years, because I think it is as if you think you're so interesting that people are absolutely dying to know everything about you. Therefore, it's all too crippling for words. Whereas actually, now as I get older, because you see I'm going to turn into my mother, but now I feel that sometimes it is a discourtesy to be very shy, because somehow, not your job, but I think it is incumbent on you to make someone else feel at ease. And if you're being very shy, somehow it gets all the attention on you in some obscure way. I don't know if you know what I mean. So although I think she was being harsh, and it's a very harsh judgment indeed to say that it's just about self-absorption and arrogance, there is an element of truth in that. And I think that if you make it your job when you speak to someone to try and make them at ease, you forget about whether you're shy or not.
Nigella Lawson is the author of, among other books, How to Eat, How to Be a Domestic Goddess. And she's also the host of Forever Summer and Nigella Bites on the Style Network. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Nadia. And Nadia's on the line with us from Long Island in New York.
Hello, Nigella.
Hello, this is my cousin, Nadia.
That's right. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I was calling because I haven't spoken to you for so long, and I was interested in hearing you talking about depression and eating.
Well, it's a, you know, I could.
It's always good
to
have family call.
I could
isn't
do
it?
A 20, yeah, 24 hour. Yes, and all of my family are absolute experts on both depression and eating.
And cooking, and remember Mommy's cooking?
Of course I do.
Nigella was kind enough to mention my mother in her book, and Mummy was an incredible cook, and I don't think I'd take after her, but I love cooking, and I have looked at your egg-shaped bowl and wondered.
Well, thank you.
Nadia, thank you so much for being with us.
Lots of love.
Right, bye-bye.
And to you, Nadia.
Her phone call makes it possible for me to ask a question also about your name, which some people have found unusual. You're named after your father.
Well, I am, although, in fact, it's a flower or a seed. the flowers called nigellics as little black seeds. And as a form of, I suppose, egomania, culinary egomania, I often use nigella seeds in cooking. The Indians use them a lot. I think they're called kalenji or kalonji in Indian cooking. They're also sometimes called black mustard seeds. So, yes, it is a completely ridiculous name, but at least it's nice to know that I'm a spice.
Nigel Lawson, Nigella's father, was Chancellor of the Exchequer during the Thatcher administration in Britain. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Caroline, who's with us from Kansas City.
Hello, Nigella. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
I wanted to tell you a story about your Boxing Day pie.
Carry on, please.
I love the Boxing Day pie, and my husband does, too. And similar to your story about the roast chicken, I'm not allowed to make only one at a time.
Oh, really? That's really wonderful.
But what I wanted to tell you is that 2 years ago, my brother-in-law had spinal meningitis and thankfully has recovered wonderfully.
Oh, goodness.
But at that point, as you can imagine, you know, the whole family had gathered. And he actually was out of the hospital at the time, and we were all taking turns cooking for everyone, like you do. And so I had decided that we were all going to have Boxing Day pie, because certainly everyone would love that. And so I brought all the ingredients over, tons of bacon, masses of onions, all this pie dough, and sort of put all the sisters to work. And his faculties were a bit reduced, so he didn't smell the onions so much. But we hit a point where literally everyone went running from the house because so much onion oil had gotten worked up that we were all just weeping. So if you can imagine, literally this mass of women in the kitchen that all of a sudden we look at each other with tears streaming down our faces and go running from the kitchen, and he's sitting in the living room kind of going, what's going on? And so everyone loved it. It was wonderful. I think we made 6 that day.
Well, I'm so pleased it had a happy ending.
Yes, it did have a happy ending. But,
for those of us in confusion, just describe for us briefly what the Boxing Day pie is.
Well, the way I make it is slightly different, of course, than the way it's described, in that I use actual bacon and not pancetta. But
yeah, but the same.
One of the great things I found here is that you can get the sort of pre-cooked bacon. Mm-hmm. With less grief, and so it's Boxing Day is the day after Christmas Day in England. It's also a little bit wonderful for me because I lived in England for a while, so I get to sort of be an expat that isn't. But it's bacon and onions mostly, and egg. I kind of describe it as a quiche with 5 times as much bacon and less egg.
Yes, and pastry casing. But you know the story when you told me that story, I'll tell you later. I just think it's about crying as, you know, aloud because you were going through a difficult time.
Yes.
Yeah, Caroline, thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for making it easy for us.
Oh, thank you.
Nigella Lawson, thank you for making it easy for me this past 40 minutes. We appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you. I've loved being here.
Nigella Lawson hosts the food programs Nigella Bites and Forever Summer. She's the author of How to Eat, How to Be a Domestic Goddess, and, of course, their most recent book, Forever Summer. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking about the Sasser computer worm. Have you been hit? I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.